Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
As a person with a very deep voice, I'm hired all the time for advertising campaigns. But a deep voice doesn't sell B2B. And advertising on the wrong platform doesn't sell B2B either. That's why if you're a B2B marketer, you should use LinkedIn ads. LinkedIn has the targeting capabilities to help you reach the world's largest professional audience. That's right, over 70 million decision makers all in one place. All the big wigs, then medium wigs. Also small wigs who are on the path to becoming big wigs. Okay, that's enough about Wix. LinkedIn ads allows you to focus on getting your B2B message to the right people. So, does that mean you should use ads on LinkedIn instead of hiring me, the man with the deepest voice in the world? Yes. Yes, it does. Get started today and see why LinkedIn is the place to be, to be. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What is The Briefing Room?
It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the criminal justice system works and the lives of the people within that system.
If you love true crime, well, these are the real people who do the job every day of making sure justice is served.
Hi, I'm Detective Dave.
I'm Detective Dan. Together, we have decades of experience in local law enforcement, a profession that we think is often misunderstood.
So we're going to explore how to do it right, and we won't shy away from when it's done wrong. These are stories you'll hear nowhere else. Unique, frank, and unvarnished.
From the team that brought you Small Town Dicks, this is The Briefing Room. Episode 1 drops on August 30th.
We'll meet you in The Briefing Room.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is writer, director, and editor Paul Owens. His feature directorial debut, Landlocked, is currently available at select theaters and on VOD. Welcome to the show!
Hey, that was nice. Thanks for that intro. I'm good.
You're welcome!
Thanks for joining us. We're really excited to talk both about your film and then the movie you brought with you today. So let's start with Landlocked. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this film?
Oh god, deja vu. Jeez, I don't know. yeah, it's a movie. Oh god, I made. It's a movie. It's a movie I made. It stars my family, my brothers, my dad, my mom, and. The concept was we kind of adapted our old family home videos into sort of like a time travel horror sci-fi story. And so the main character is my brother, Mason. He kind of plays himself. We all kind of play ourselves like in the present day. But he kind of comes back to the family home, which is going to be torn down. And he finds like an old VHS camera that can see into the past and record things. And he kind of becomes obsessed with documenting the past and... he kind of becomes ensnared in the memories and things get spooky and there's all sorts of good stuff. It's good. It's a good movie.
It's really good. So How did you go about constructing this? Because you said you used it from from old home movies. How did you come up with this concept, and how did you incorporate all of that and get everything together? That sounds like a monumental task.
I know. When I was starting to do it, I was like, "Why am I doing this? God, this is so much work." Jesus Christ! Like one day, and I was like, "Shit!" And then 8 years later, I'm like still talking about this stuff and doing it basically. But anyway. I guess the origins was I came home after a couple years away from home. Like, things had definitely changed. Like, my parents had gotten divorced. Like, my older brother was out of the house at that point. Things were different. And definitely a weird feeling, weird time in my life. And similar to the character in the movie, I'm just sort of, like, aimlessly wandering around, going through things, trying to sort of reconnect with the past. And I found like an old box of home movies, and watching them, I was struck by just how much things had changed. And I didn't really feel a connection to these people in the video anymore. And it was just so weird watching that, you know, seeing like my living room in the video where we're all a happy family talking, being together, and then cut to present day. I'm watching the house is falling apart. No one's around. And it seemed like there was a movie there. And then we did it. Yeah.
So how many years did this movie take to make?
I mean, at least 10.
Jeez.
The script, I was writing it in earnest in 2012. I know that. 2014, we started shooting it. 2018, we got the last little bits. Then it was in pre-production. And then once quarantine rolled around, I was like, I should probably finish this thing because it's becoming a little embarrassing that it's just sitting around now. And... so, and then that's kind of why we're here. I finished it up, got it out, and coming out tomorrow. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Crazy.
And what was your experience like? I know I asked you this question in our other interview, but just pretend I didn't.
No, you didn't.
What was your experience like working with almost exclusively your family on this movie?
It was amazing. I mean, it was super emotional. It was just... I don't know. It was satisfying to get these things out in the open and really like dissect them, talk about them, be like, you felt that way? I felt that way too. It's, you know, there's a lot of takes that ended with us in tears, you know, just like it was a lot of emotions. And, you know, I was just saying it was like some takes ended with us laughing as well, like just at really inappropriate times when like people were dying on screen, just like couldn't stop laughing, that kind of thing. And it was cathartic, I think, actually. And yeah, I feel like now looking back, whenever I see anyone, I'm like, we're talking about the movie, and it's just like it is a weirdly fond experience like that we all kind of shared together. So it is emotional, and I am getting teary-eyed again thinking about it, like I did in the last interview. When I was watching it with an audience for the first time in a theater, like in the back of the theater, I was watching the whole thing, and just seeing like my brothers and family up there like acting, like being amazing and like making something beautiful out of this like just idea I had was like, damn, this is got me misty-eyed for sure.
That's so cool.
It's been an intense ride. So yeah, just all this week I've just been thinking about it and just like, damn, gotta do this, wipe these tears, because it's just like feels really weird to like put this personal thing out and like have it be something people review is really weird. Like give it a star rating is like really strange to be like, your family's 4 out of 5 stars.
your authentic family experience that you are trying to capture is getting a star rating. That is a weird experience.
So
you're like,
weird.
Wait, like my home movies are getting like rated by critics. I didn't even think about how strange of an experience that must be.
Yeah, I hate to tell you, Dad, but you only got 3 stars this time, you know?
So the other reason I was really excited to chat with you is when I was looking at your IMDb page, I saw Double Fine Adventure. And as someone that was a Kickstarter, it wasn't even Kickstarter. I can't even remember what platform they used. But
yeah, it was Kickstarter.
Kickstarter? I couldn't remember if it was that or if they had shifted, because they went to some other one for Psychonauts 2. I couldn't remember. But yeah, I was at a Kickstarter member of that, and I watched that series the entire time. And to see that on your resume, it was like this, what?
Holy shit. No one has ever brought up those two things, like during landlocked interviews, no one's mentioned that like at all, and vice versa. So that's crazy.
I mean, I have to, because I was like, I love Double Fine. I love Tim Schafer. I love all of the stuff they do. Shit. And so when I saw that on there, I was like, fuck yeah, I get to nerd out a little bit. What was that like filming that for, gosh, it was like 3 years in a period, wasn't it? Talk about long commitments.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, you ain't seen nothing yet, man. There's another one coming.
Ooh.
It was amazing. I mean, everyone there is a genius, and they're super smart, super funny. It's just like, sometimes I don't know what I did to like be able to just be in the presence of such brilliant people and to be able to like ask them questions and pick their brains and see how they work. And, you know, it's not exactly filmmaking. You know, I can't learn as much if I was working on like a film, but I feel like I learned a lot about life just being around these people that, you know, pretty brilliant folk for sure.
And I mean, that company had so many ups and downs before they got to that point, and it's just like to see that. And that was, I think, was so cool watching that as like a fan of Tim Schafer and what they do, was seeing the warts and all the ups and downs of making, okay, we just got money from Kickstarter, how are we going to do it? And so I just wanted to say that was so cool to see that you were involved in that.
Wow, so flattered. That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Terry texted me last night. He's like, I can't wait to ask him about this. And I was like, yay.
You're not supposed to tell anyone I'm a video game nerd, okay? I'm a horror guy, all right? Just keep it to yourself.
Well, cut.
Okay,
cut.
Well, so you did cut. Say... that you're a horror guy. So let's go back to the very beginning. How did you get introduced to horror?
Jeez Louise. I was thinking about this and trying to dredge up these old memories. God, it's just like some of this stuff I haven't thought about in years and years. And some of it is kind of a revelation to be like, shit, that was like the start, wasn't it? It kind of echoes through your life in a way. Like Night of the Living Dead was definitely the first one I remember being like, okay, this is the first thing the earliest one that I can remember. And we had an old VHS of it. I don't even know how or why we had it, because we weren't really a horror family. And now I think it had something to do with the copyright, probably. I'm assuming the weird copyright made it be like it was a dollar in some bin somewhere and someone picked it up. And it ended up in our spot. So maybe when I was like 3 or 4, I was like super young, but we had the tape.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And I remember just like it took multiple times to watch the whole thing, because like put it in and maybe get to the part where the first zombie shows up and then be like, stop, I can't watch this, too scary, too scary. And then maybe a week later, it's like, okay, one more shot. And I make it up to like when she gets into the house, maybe.
Oh, wow.
And maybe it took like 5 times to make it to the end. And
oh, wow.
Obviously, the ending was something else.
Yeah.
But I feel like I still pull from that movie a lot. And it was shot in Pennsylvania and I was in Jersey, and I grew up in like an old farmhouse, and it takes place in an old farmhouse, and there was just a lot of like things that brought it close to home, where I was like, shit, this could happen in my backyard, it could be happening right now. And so I think that's why I kind of flipped out for that one, and it's still sort of part of my vocabulary working today.
You said you were like 4 or 5 when you saw that?
God, I must have been.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
3 or 4.
Wow, what an indelible memory. I can't imagine seeing that at that young age. It's scary. It's a scary movie.
It is, yeah.
So did that like increase your love of horror, or did you go seek it out after that, or did it scare you kind of away from it?
I was kind of mentioning in the last interview, it was more just like the iconography was everywhere. Like just Freddy was always like in the early 90s, like Freddy and Jason were just like always there. Like the Freddy TV show, I remember like watching that. Like that was a little
Freddy's
easier
Nightmares.
To get to. Freddy's Nightmares. There you go.
Yeah, I love that show.
I don't
As a
remember
kid,
anything
I've not seen
it
since then.
Yeah. So I remember them, and I remember like a kid dressing up as Freddy for Halloween in kindergarten, and him getting in a lot of trouble for that. like getting sent to the principal for dressing as Freddy for Halloween.
Oh my God.
So those were the early ones, just like the iconography. I never even saw the movies until way later. And there were a couple things that stuck out, like you guys are big Alien people, right? Are you a family?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Terry, cool. Terry especially is the Alien freak.
Okay. Nice. I do remember flipping around on the TV and seeing, I came on the scene where Parker and Lambert get killed, that bit. Mm-hmm. And that was like the most terrifying thing I'd ever seen at that point. That was maybe like 5 or something. But that was just...
Good God.
I still have the memory of that, like the corridor of seeing, like, it's not even how it was in the actual movie, I realize, but I have this other memory that is just still strong after however many years, 30 years, longer, 35.
So you said you were like 5 when you saw that? Or that, like, that clip?
That bit. That
one. Jesus. I was 8 when my parents sat me down to watch this movie, and I've told the story when we covered it, but like, I got to the dinner scene and I had no idea what was going to happen. And when it burst out of his chest, I was like, okay, I'm done. This is too much for my little brain.
Okay. I didn't see that part. I only saw the xenomorph killing these two, but that was
terrifying enough. That's a scary movie.
Did the trick.
Especially at that age.
Yeah. So that's sort of like a memory I can't get out.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, cause you thought that you like a lot of horror iconography and you saw some horror movies, but you know, now that you're making horror movies, was there a moment in your head, maybe as you got older, that clicked that was like, I really like horror. I want to like actively seek it out and make horror movies.
No, I was just saying, God, I don't know why. I loved horror, but it wasn't like the genre I was looking to make films in. It just sort of happened that way. And it seemed like, oh, here's the story. But it would come out scary. It would come out like spooky and like weird, and yeah, so it wasn't by choice at all. And yeah, it's only been after I've started to make these movies that I've been like, I should watch more of these things. So yeah, I'm still like trying to figure it out, really. So
have you seen any movies recently that like really spoke to you, horror movies in particular?
I mean, it sounds really basic. I was trying to think about this last night, like, which really obscure one have I seen recently to really try to impress people? But I feel like Hereditary was the big one recently, which I feel like is not original at all. But like, I got to go be honest and say that one really freaked me out in a way that I hadn't really felt in a really long time.
So, it comes up on the podcast an awful lot. It's a great choice.
Thank
it's
you.
Terrifying.
Choice. It's really scary. I watched it recently. It's still really fucking scary. No matter how many times I've seen it, it still fucking scares me.
I don't want to watch it again, like, to be honest. Like, I do and I don't. But Killing of a Sacred Deer comes to mind as well, just because that was I guess I wish I could make something like this. Like, I wish I'd made this movie. It's so good. That really scared me, too. Yeah, those are kind of the more recent ones. The Witch, It Follows, other really obvious choices, I feel like, but great.
Do you have any subgenres that you really feel that you gravitate more towards within the horror space?
God, I mean, anything with like just that sense of dread, you know, because it's like it's still a little bit of a mystery, even though it's kind of in my movies as well, like why it's working on me. It's like, why does this affect me so much? Like, what are these feelings that these movies are conjuring up in me, and how are they doing this? And even when I do it, I'm like, how did I do that? why does this work? You know, I still feel like I'm trying to figure it out in a way.
Yeah.
So cool. Your film incorporates a lot of found footage techniques. Are you a fan of the subgenre? Mary Beth's laughing because she has turned me into a found footage person through the course of...
I also asked him the same question. He was
did
like,
you really?
Not until people like you were calling it found footage.
Did that sound mean when I said that? I didn't mean it that way.
Absolutely not. I wear it as a badge of honor, honestly. If I wear it as a badge of honor.
Okay. Yeah, not until people like you guys started bringing it up. No, I was trying to make like a documentary narrative hybrid. I was like, this is going to be like a new kind of movie. No one's ever seen this before. And then people are like, it's a found footage movie, right? It's like, yeah, I guess so.
Okay, but let me get on my soapbox really, really fast just for a brief second.
You're not wrong.
You are working within a new kind of found footage filmmaking technique that I think is going to become more popular, but you are at, I think, like the beginning of hybrid found footage and incorporating found footage elements into more traditional narrative horror filmmaking. And I think it's so cool to see more films do that. And I think your film was one of the first I actually saw doing that like months ago when we first saw it on the festival circuit. So I think what you were out to accomplish, you actually did. And I think it is something that is still very fresh and new in the genre space. So, kudos.
Well, thank you.
I'm off my soapbox now.
Very flattering. No, it's very flattering. I appreciate it.
Terry is so used to me doing this.
You said a lot of really nice things online. I didn't say this before, but like, yeah, I definitely noticed because I was looking for all the nice stuff you said. And it's all very kind. So I thank you for that.
You made a good movie. I mean, like, what can I say?
What can you say?
But before we get into the other good movie that we're talking about today, we are going to take a super quick break.
As a person with a very deep voice, I'm hired all the time for advertising campaigns. But a deep voice doesn't sell B2B. And advertising on the wrong platform doesn't sell B2B either. That's why if you're a B2B marketer, you should use LinkedIn ads. LinkedIn has the targeting capabilities to help you reach the world's largest professional audience. That's right, over 70 million decision makers all in one place. All the big wigs, then medium wigs. Also small wigs who are on the path to becoming big wigs. Okay, that's enough about Wix. LinkedIn ads allows you to focus on getting your B2B message to the right people. So, does that mean you should use ads on LinkedIn instead of hiring me, the man with the deepest voice in the world? Yes. Yes, it does. Get started today and see why LinkedIn is the place to be, to be. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
From the break. So, Paul, what movie have you brought with you today for us to discuss?
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh my god. Let us share a brief synopsis of this incredible film that everyone who has heard this podcast and has heard me and Terry talk about it is probably very excited for us to be chatting about it today. But in Bram Stoker's Dracula, the centuries-old vampire Count Dracula comes to England to seduce his barrister Jonathan Harker's fiancée, Mina Murray, and inflict havoc in the foreign land. Dun,
dun, dun. Wow, is that the plot? Okay.
That's cool. According to IMDb.
That's IMDb. We don't write
these. It's our favorite place to go.
It's come sometimes a joke at this point, because they're really bad synopsis, yeah. And they're even funnier, but yeah.
Okay, so take us back. How did you first see this movie? I mean, you've talked about seeing movies at 3 and 4 and 5. So I'm curious, how old were you when you saw this? How did you see this? What was going through your mind this entire time? Give us your horror story.
I must have been 8. I think it was third grade, which is, I don't know if that's old or not. I'm not sure. Especially nowadays. This is definitely like pre-internet era. So just to kind of like set the mood a little bit. But I watched the making of, and Coppola calls it a dark, erotic nightmare. And that's definitely what the experience was for me watching this. So god damn, how do I even start? So I was in third grade, but I feel like it might have well been preschool because I was kind of a sheltered kid and like super shy and like didn't have too many friends. Like definitely was way more comfortable like writing little stories in a notebook and then acting them out with my toys, you know, that kind of thing. And
oh my god, Paul, that's my childhood. That's my childhood.
Cool.
I read and wrote little stories too. Like I was a nerd. We were all nerds.
There you go. And so I could definitely feel like in my third grade class that I was not as worldly as the other kids. I could definitely sense that they knew a lot more than me about a lot of stuff. And I wasn't really allowed to watch R-rated movies. I'm not sure. Was this your guys' experience too?
My parents were weird. Originally, they let me watch a lot of stuff as long as I covered my eyes during nudity.
Oh, okay. There you go.
And then that they became more conservative over the course of my childhood. And then I was not allowed to watch them. So,
goodness. Yeah.
My mom tried to keep me from watching rated R movies just because she was like, you're a child. And the rules with my dad were very lax, which I will share more about my specific experience watching this movie with my dad at an incredibly young age. But nudity and sex were definitely like, go into the other room while this is happening kind of scenario in my family. But yeah, we were pretty. My mom tried to for a while keep it on lock, but it didn't last very long.
God, we're so aligned. This is scary. Okay. my mom was like super like, she'd really flip out. And in fact, like she's definitely not, I'm not going to send her this podcast, like, because I'm not sending her this at all. She was like anti-nudity to like a really insane degree where it was like, I remember her like flipping out about my brother seeing Carlito's Way because it had nudity in it. Which I saw it years later. It's like barely anything. I was like, that? Come on. But back then it was like so serious, and like if she found out I'd seen this movie, she would have taken my Super Nintendo away like so fast, and like, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
that's a travesty. That's a super.
Like, I think Dirty Dancing was maybe the most risque thing I'd seen at that point.
Oh, my parents probably wouldn't let me watch Dirty Dancing because it had Dirty Dancing in the title. I was not allowed to watch that.
Nice. Good one, all right. Actually, weird tangent. Like, how many other kinds of movies do you guys watch? Are you just horror, or are you like, I watch everything?
Oh, I watch everything.
Oh, I watch everything. Oh, yeah. And, oh, yeah. I'm a big, my husband really loves, like, Japanese like samurai movies, so we watch a lot of those. Ooh. we're a big animation anime household as well. Yeah, I watch everything. Nice. Horror is the primary, but it helps to have someone who isn't. My husband loves horror, but he's not as much, so it's helpful to have him like get me out of watching only horror movies all the time. I also watch a lot of horrific reality television.
Ooh. Okay.
I don't do
that. That is scary.
Yeah. It is scary.
No, it's terrifying. And it's like, I understand it's not great, but sometimes I just want to watch rich white women be mean to each other.
No, I get it. No, I really get it, honestly.
I own my truth here.
It's a safe space.
Yes, I was saying this is a safe perv space for the night, because I was lamenting the fact that I'm going to sound like a perv coming out of this, and I really don't mean to be, but
oh no,
don't worry.
Don't worry,
it's just what a perv. It's public, terrible. Anyway, so I was at a sleepover, my best friend at the time, and he's like, hey, check it out, look what I got. And he was like, okay, ooh, rated R, okay, all right. Like, when you're a kid, you definitely don't want to act like you're afraid around your friends, because you'll never hear the end of it, and maybe they'll be like beating you up next year. Like, things change really fast when you're a kid, you know? So
yeah.
I definitely remember going off some bicycle jumps that I didn't really want to. I was just like, I can't be like, I'm afraid around this stuff. I gotta nearly kill myself. Anyway, so we're at the sleepover, and I'm looking at the box, and it's like Coppola, who I never heard of that guy before. But I knew like Carpenter, Craven, I knew like the horror movie guys. So I was like, this must be like one of those horror movie guys that like had their name above the title. And like, I'd seen their stuff. And like, by that point, it was a little like, not as scary. That stuff, like Freddy was maybe getting a little goofy, like by that time, like, you know.
Yeah. And
so I was like, okay, this should be okay. And then when it starts, there was a different tone to it than I was used to. Like, it felt like this was a movie made by adults for adults, and they weren't thinking about kids. So right away, there was like a weird, like unknowable terror kind of happening, like that I didn't really understand. And I was a little older at that point, so it was like, okay, this isn't too bad. It's not too bad. But we get to the Arabian Nights bookshop.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I, you know, like I said, pre-internet, we hadn't had like the family life class in school or anything. Like, we hadn't had anything like that, and that was sort of surprising, finding out that way. I feel like it should have been more like a diagram or a chart somewhere in class or something. Felt weird.
Seeing that moment at a slumber party, and that is how you're finding out about sex, is that...
Isn't that weird? Because, I mean, you hear rumors. You hear, like, you know, you kind of know maybe what's going on, but like, basically it was like, okay, I'm going to do a thing. My hands right here, where it's like, this is like the extent of, what, and I don't even know what that means really. Like, at that point,
finger through the
like,
okay sign, listeners, finger through the okay sign.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was, that's all I knew. And you're trying to pretend like you know more than that.
Right.
And the bad kids in school, they definitely, it seemed like they knew more what was up, because maybe their dad had like a porno collection or, you know, or something. They had HBO, which we didn't have. Like, we basically had like the basic TV package, and like I said, everything that came in was filtered heavily.
Yep.
So that was different. That was the different thing that was happening. And I was like, holy shit. And then so in the back of my mind, I'm starting to think like, okay, if my mom finds out I actually watched this movie, which like, she's friends with my friend's mom, like they talk, it could easily be like, oh, what'd the kids do? And it's like, they watched a movie. And she'd be like, what movie? And then she would be like, I don't know, Dracula or something, because she didn't care. But my mom would have been like, okay, he's going to be grounded and I'm going to whoop his ass. Like, this is what's going to happen.
So, or Super Nintendo for Paul.
I love that Super Nintendo. You don't know.
Oh, me too.
Oh, my God.
So it's like, in the back of my head, like, this fear is growing, like, even greater than the movie almost, of like, what my mom would do to me if she found out I was watching this movie. And I'm like, but so far, it's just an illustration on a page. I could be like, oh, I didn't see that part. I must have been getting candy or something. But
in the bathroom.
Then, then the actual erotic nightmare started. Basically the turning point was when Monica Bellucci came up out of the bed, which I'd never seen a naked woman before, which was surprising.
Oh boy!
To see where everything's at and all that jazz.
I just cannot.
Monica Bellucci's so hot. And she is a great star. A bunch of third graders watching this movie, like boy, young eighth grade, not eighth grade, third grade boys watching this movie. Like, the energy in that room must have been so bizarre. I can't even imagine.
Weird. He was like in the living room too. So part of me was like afraid that like his mom would come out and be like, "What?
What's going on out here, boys?"
Yeah. Yeah, so it was a lot at that point. Yeah, yeah, and that was okay though. But the worst one was when Wolf Dracula is with Lucy on the bench there in the garden. Was like, holy shit! And I actually like got up, hit stop, and I don't even know why I did this, because it's just so embarrassing that I would like care so much. But like, I was just, I got up, turned the hit stop, and like ran out of the room and like. It's definitely one of those, you know, those memories you have where you think about them in bed at 4 a.m. and you're just like, oh, yeah. Why did I do that? Mm-hmm. This is like one out of a thousand that I'll cycle through on a given night and be like, why didn't I just like keep my cool and watch this movie? God damn.
I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot to deal with. I could not imagine seeing this movie as an 8-year-old.
I saw this movie as an 11-year-old. I think I was 11. Yeah. I was 11. I saw. So my parents were divorced. My dad was the horror parent. I would go to his house on the weekends. We'd watch horror movies, and like rules didn't matter at his house. Like, you know, the typical divorce kid narrative. And so he used me to basically watch the movies that he like rewatch movies he wanted to watch without kind of maybe thinking that maybe an 11-year-old shouldn't be watching Bram Stoker's Dracula. I believe I was 11. I was really young because at the point where Monica Bellucci's beautiful naked body came out from the bed and they start having like their weird orgy situation, my dad made me cover. He sat next to me and covered my eyes, and all I could hear were the noises. And I kid you not, I was like, "Is that what sex sounds like?"
Ooh.
And I was just like, "It is." It's Monica Bellucci licking your nipple for just 15 minutes straight.
And honestly, it's gushing blood.
Oh my god.
But that was the moment that they covered my eyes, and for the longest time I didn't watch this movie again. I didn't know what happened. I had no idea. And when I watched it years later, I was like, yeah, I guess I probably shouldn't have seen. That was one of those rare instances where I was like, yeah, you know what? I probably shouldn't have been allowed to see that. That and the sex scene in American Psycho that I shouldn't have seen at a young age, that my parents made me leave the room. Whoa. I was like, I probably shouldn't be watching American Psycho like in high school. Wow. With my whole family. But anyway, that's a story for another time. But yeah, werewolf. But I don't remember him having the same reaction to the werewolf fucking, though. Like, I don't remember my dad. I don't have that memory of my dad doing that. I do remember my dad's girlfriend at the time was going to be his second wife, was like, Mark, I don't think we should be showing this to her.
Oh, yeah, Mark.
And he was like, it's fine. And I was like, I don't think this is fine. Like, I'm all about, like, letting your kids watch stuff, but this one's a lot. Like, this is a lot. Like, this movie is an erotic nightmare. I guess at the werewolf and Mina scene is just absolutely, like,
he's having an orgasm there on screen, which, like, to a kid, that makes no sense at all. It's like, why is he making that face? what's he doing?
Also, it's like, the fr- on screen is an orgy with vampire women and then a wolf, like, having sex with a woman who is asleep in a garden and is, or, like, I'm not gonna ask, but wow, that must have been very formative for your sexual awakening as a child. Sorry.
Things didn't make up till a few years later is the thing. That's a problem. They didn't make up till later. They were still asleep.
Slumbering.
Slumbering. So you turned it off and then you fled the room? Is that?
Yeah. And to my friend's credit, he came and coaxed me back in, and he didn't hold it against me at all. He wasn't like, you know, didn't beat me up the next year. We were still cool. But
so did you finish the movie?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I did. God, yeah, I don't remember beyond that point, really. That's kind of the part that my memory sort of gets a little hazy. I think so. I honestly can't remember. I think I was just like out of body at that point.
Wow.
Yeah, that's basically it, though. Yeah.
So did your mom never found out, I take it?
To this day. I mean, that's why I definitely don't want her to hear this. So no one sent it to her, for sure.
She's going to take away your Super Nintendo now, retroactively.
Yeah, I get it. She could. I mean, she got way more lax with my younger brother, though. Like, by the time she had her fourth child, it was like, whatever, anything goes, you know?
Yeah, it's always I know like how that goes. So,
are you the oldest?
Second.
Second oldest, second. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yes. Wait, so Terry, when was the first time you saw this movie?
Well, so the first time I saw this movie was last year, Mary Beth, when I got bullied into watching it.
I did bully you into watching it. My brain's broken.
And one of our listeners bullied me into watching this movie, finally. And I
didn't know what sex was yet.
I didn't know what sex was. My sexual awakening was the werewolf fucking.
Last year. Yeah.
So bizarre.
Last year.
41 years old, finally learning what that's all about. No. Okay. I have a very weird relationship with this movie because for two reasons. One, my knowledge of this story comes from the Bram Stoker's Dracula Sega CD video game.
Ooh. No, I had the Super Nintendo one. Oh my God. It's crazy you bring that up. I forgot.
Sega CD version has clips from this movie that are so compressed. So pixelated and so out of order, but like it starts with Dracula throwing his sword at the cross, and then the gushing blood and him drinking, and then all of a sudden you're Harker and you are punching bats and kicking rats and jumping over weird things on the ground. I don't know if they're giant bear traps or what, but there are these things on the ground that you're jumping over, and you eventually start punching spiders. And you fight Dracula, who's throwing fireballs at you. At one point, you do fight Lucy in her wedding dress glory, and you kick her head off.
Nice.
And there's all these little clips from the movie.
Side note, there was definitely a very brief joking moment that I was like, I should have my wedding dress be like Lucy's.
Mary Beth, that would have been amazing.
That would have been so funny.
Wait, with the collar that comes out? That one?
Oh, yeah. Oh, fuck yeah. I got married on Halloween, so it would have been perfect. But it was just maybe, it wasn't quite my taste. Not quite my style.
But it was like this really bad beat-em-up game that obviously they spent so much money on the licensing of it that they just like, I don't know, throw some bats in here and just have Harker punch them. It didn't even look like Keanu.
Yeah, it was not a good game, but it did have some cool atmosphere. I'm going to say that about it. Like, it had a cool, like, kind of like soundscape going on, and like, so it had like a weirdly ahead of its time like tone to the whole thing that was spooky, but the gameplay itself was kind of whatever. But I had that game too. That's crazy.
But the thing is that my dad would not let me watch this movie. I was, when it came out in 92, it probably got it on VHS sometime late 92 or 93, so I would have been somewhere between 11 and 12 when it came out. And I remember, I have this vivid memory of, because we were in Alaska, and when at this point I had like a little loft. They had a 2-bedroom house that had a loft, and then my brother came along and he got the room, and so I was living in the loft. And I remember nighttime, my dad was watching this movie downstairs. And so whenever there was a movie that I was not allowed to watch, I would sometimes try to crawl and like sneak around and look down the because like they had like a, what is that? A banister, like a railing. And so I could like peek down, and I remember peeking down and seeing The only scene I saw was the orgy scene.
Oh my God.
And what is with us, y'all? Why is the orgy scene the only one we saw?
And I remember seeing this going, what is happening? And then my dad happened to look up at that time. I don't know if I gasped or what. He's like, go to your bed.
I mean, that is like, you do start to look around when you're watching this movie a little bit. Like, there's a lot of moaning where I'm just like, are my neighbors hearing this? I should turn this down. There's a lot of like looking around when you're watching this movie.
I feel like you're watching porn sometimes. Like, a lot of this movie is very pornographic.
It's dirty. In the best way.
Yeah, oh my God.
So, like, that is literally, for years, the only thing I knew about this movie was the Keanu Reeves sex scene that my dad said, go to your bed, and playing the Sega CD game in which you were punching and kicking bats. Like, that
exactly
for the
longest how Francis Ford Coppola wanted you to experience and know this incredible film.
God, I want to shoot Coppola playing the game and just see what he thinks of it. Just be like, here, just try this, see how this plays. I just want to see this 8-year-old guy try playing.
Do you remember the scene where Harker punches a bat?
You wrote that in your movie, right? Like, you took the book and you know, you added that in there for artistic flair of Jonathan Harker, played by Keanu Reeves, punching bats in this dilapidated castle.
Dracula throwing fireballs? Sounds right up his alley.
It sounds like they tried to make Castlevania, but then not make Castlevania.
Yeah, kind of.
Oh, yeah.
I fucking love Castlevania. Anyway. Okay, but have you either of you read Dracula?
Oh, yeah.
I was going to do it for this podcast, and then I was like, didn't do it.
Didn't actually do it. That's okay. If you want to hear more soapbox, me talking about how Dracula is the first example of found footage, which is an epistolary novel, and epistolary novels are literary forms of found footage because there are letters written back and forth.
Wow.
It all comes back to found footage for me specifically.
And Bram didn't even realize it. He was like, "Okay, sure."
He's like, "Sure, this weirdo in a couple hundred years will just talk crazily about my book. It's fine." Obviously this is very much more sexual movie than the book, but we have this is like a loyal, not really, kind of, not actually, adaptation of the book. Not really.
I would say that it hits a lot of the narrative beats that the original Dracula didn't really, like the 1932 Dracula. Like,
yeah.
I would say that it in some ways it is very faithful, minus the whole romance story.
Yeah.
And the werewolf fucking.
It definitely keeps a lot more of like these intricacies of like the relationships between Nina and Jonathan, and then we also have like the Renfield stuff, and then Lucy Suitors. A lot of characters, obviously, but I think, let's just starting from the beginning, I think the opening to this movie is one of the most beautiful and disgusting openings of a film I've ever seen. Absolutely obsessed with the opening sequence where they are explaining Dracula as a like who he was historically, and then showing the armor that I feel like we all kind of know and love about from Dracula, that looks like the muscles from the incredible, oh my God, I totally forgot her name, the costume designer.
So while you're looking that up, that was actually my other memory of this movie. And it was because in college, I was taking a class. I don't remember what it was, but I think it was a philosophy class, and we were talking about this scene and like metaphor in it with the colors and stuff. And so I did see the opening scene with the muscle red armor and the cross and everything. I did see that in college, and that was probably the only, aside from the 20 seconds I saw of the orgy, the only thing I had seen until last year.
But Aiko Ishioka was the costume designer. She recently passed away, sadly. But all of the costume design work in this film is absolutely impeccable. Like, Gary, I will talk about Gary Oldman and his beautiful outfits forever. But I think between her design with the armor that looks like a human muscular system, and the colors and the symbol, and like, you know, we have the symbolism, we have him stabbing the cross and the blood coming out of it. Like, everything about it evokes to me, eroticism, though, because he has, like, he shares this really passionate kiss with his Elisabetta, which, Elisabetta. I told you I was going to be a handful this episode. Like, I warned everyone. But you can just feel that energy already. It's kind of a little bit grimy, a little bit gross, but, like, sensual. And I think that from the get-go, this movie really sets that tone in a way that I didn't notice until I watched this super recently, actually. So my best friend and his wife just had a baby, and they said, hey, we want to show Griffin, our newborn, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Do you want to be here? Because you're the horror queen. Do you want to be here for his first Bram Stoker's Dracula experience?
And I'm sorry.
It was his wife's first time seeing it, too, but they were joking and framing it as Griffin's first time seeing it.
Okay, good.
But we also got oysters. Because we were joking because, like, aphrodisiacs, and we were just, like, it was a whole bit. It was so funny. But, yeah, it was ridiculous. And then two other friends of ours had never seen it. And I was like, guys, I'm not joking when I tell you that this is the horniest horror movie you'll ever see. And, so that's after the beginning with a group of people who have seen it and not seen it and a newborn baby. They were like, oh, okay. We see what you're talking about. And then the movie begins. And And the score, too.
Oh, like, that's what I wanted to say. The opening to this with the score by, and I do not know how to pronounce this man's name, Wojciech Kilar, who,
yes,
this,
but, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It's so sumptuous. It's so erotic. It's so gothic. It's so sexy. It's so dark and mysterious. It is. When that music comes on, it's like, oh, I'm in for something operatic, something horrifying, and something incredibly erotic, and that is what we get with this movie.
And I think from there, you know, we get introduced to our lovers who, you know, we have they're very, like, timid. They've never actually really kissed before. We have Winona Ryder as our Mina, and we have Keanu Reeves with his questionable accent as Jonathan.
I was marveling at the word earth. He's like, earth. Like, the way he says earth, like, really threw me. And he says it, like, twice. And it's really weird both times.
Okay, there are two moments in this that that just grab my attention every time I watch this movie. Because I've seen this now, I think, three times since I first saw it last year. And the first one is this clip. I have a clip teed up for it.
We can be married when I return.
We can be married when I return. Married.
Can I just say, I feel like it does work for the story, though, watching it last night, because he's a little bit of a goon in the early moments of the movie, and it kind of works for the story. Like, he kind of becomes like a badass with the gray hair by the end. But, like, there's a look that Winona gives him when he says that, where she's like, just shut up and kiss me, kind of look on her face. And I'm like, it's almost like they acknowledge that he's kind of a goon and that he's pretty, but he's kind of like a goofball. So yeah. I feel like, weirdly, it really works for me anyway. Like,
it does, but this does. My favorite line, though, in this entire movie is this next one. This is literally my favorite line. I could quote it every day.
Bloody wolves chasing me through some blue inferno.
Inferno? I just love the way he attacks that word.
God, you know, watching it, I think that was a reshoot because his hair looks different. Uh-huh. It feels like they just shot him against the wall in L.A. and were like, yeah, act out that thing. And, like, he's a little, like, rusty. I feel like that must have been what happened there, because he looks totally different.
And he does. He looks different. And it sounds like he's channeling Bill and Ted, like, Excellent Adventure at that moment. It's just, like, I love that moment. That's my favorite line from this movie.
And you know what I love about Keanu? Like, I think his acting, I think he can be a really good actor, and I also think he can be not a great actor. But he puts it all in there, and he so gets cast, and I love him so much. And you know what? I appreciate it. And then him and Winona Ryder apparently got married in this movie, for real. But we can talk about that later.
Did they really?
Yeah, so there's the scene at the end where they are getting married, after Jonathan survives and they're getting married. That was apparently an actual wedding ceremony, and they got married.
Talk about method.
Yeah, seriously. So, But Paul, you get to a good point with, like, him seeming like kind of a goon, a silly goose, a guy who is just kind of, like, pretty to look at, but there isn't a lot going on. And then you have the innocent-looking Winona Ryder, Mina's character, who is contrasted to her friend Lucy, who is like, what, 15 or 16 in the movie, but looks like she's 25. Like, she's not
even.
She's like super young. I can't remember how old she actually is, but there's like a couple, there's a moment where she says like how young she is, and it's like very wild. But we have the wild and free Lucy with the controlled and kind of meek Mina, and they're the best of friends, and they bring out like the best and the worst in each other. And we have these like these typical relationships. They're very sweet, but then we get to the fucking castle, and then we see Gary Oldman as our old
Gary
Dracula
Oldman.
With his booby hair that I just want to grope. And it's just this. And then I think like Coppola isn't fucking around with this movie. Like, we get this incredible shot before we get to the castle. I'm jumping ahead, where we have Jonathan on the train, and we have the superimposition of the train, and then we have the map in the background, and like with the swelling score, and it feels like, because people know the story of Dracula, we know where he's going. Like, we know what's going to happen. And so instead of trying to be like, who, we don't know if he's going, like, what's happening, it's like very much setting up like he is going to somewhere incredibly dangerous, and we are, it is going to be a wild ride. And Coppola still just makes it the most gorgeous thing. Just a train ride makes it absolutely like a cinematic experience. And it's just, every time I watch this movie, I'm so impressed with like the visual aesthetic alone that is created here, and like the visual language of this movie. It's just so incredibly impressive with what
I know.
Creates.
I gotta shout out the shot where she commits suicide, where she jumps off the castle. Is like,
yes,
just kind of the best, one of the best shots ever that just doesn't get any credit whatsoever. And I don't know why people aren't like showing this in film school. Like, look at this shot right here. It's amazing.
It is amazing. There are a lot of gorgeous moments in this movie. I love this encounter with Dracula in the beginning, and he's old, and he's like, his hair is just, it's perfect. Like, as I was watching this last night to prepare, I was like, Dracula is a drag queen. Like, this is a drag performance right here with this hair that he has that's down his back. He like flips out over the smallest of inconveniences. He like delivers lines as if like he is tasting them. I love the moment. Well, first, I mean, there's a couple things that are like classic lines, like, I never drink wine, right? Or like, the creatures of the night, what music they make. Or I love the line where he's like, they say you are a man of good taste. And it's just like the way he like lingers on these lines are just, it's perfect. He is so good in this movie.
He's just like having such a good time being such a campy vampire, like a campy, he's in that ridiculous robe with the ridiculous train. Like, everything about it is just opulent. And it's so funny because, funny, but it's like the contrast is wild because the entire castle is falling apart. It's like the definition of like ruins of a castle, but then you have this opulent old man who has long white hair and has this ridiculously bright red robe and is obviously like takes care in what he looks like, and you have that contrast, which is so fascinating, and again, like, draws your eye to Dracula, and you can't stop looking at him, even if he is, you know, he's very old and he has the long nails and is meant to look maybe more monstrous. You cannot take your eyes off of him. Like, he is so all consuming, like, pun intended.
I think that's my favorite version of Dracula in the movie. Like, I don't love the young version as much. Like, the old guy is like just so great. Everything
he has impeccable style as a young man, though.
That's true.
Those glasses are so hipster, but so glorious. I love them so much. Those, what are they, blue or purple? Like, they just, they have so much color to them.
The perched on his nose kind of thing.
Can I mention the most disturbing part for me, like, present day, was with the old man. Keanu, like, takes his hands or something, and there's, like, weird hair, like, coming out over his things for, like, a split second. And I was like, that actually got to me. I was like, shit, my God. Like, I don't know why that's the moment now that scares me, but there's something really unnerving about the hairy top of hands. The old man hair is scary. Yeah.
It is scary because it's like that kind of, I mean, he looks so unnatural in that beginning moment, but then when you have like this very human touch moment and you look down and you are, it is Tufts of Hair. I mean, it's kind of foreshadowing the fact that he's also Wolf, but it's like, that moment is just like, what just happened there? I can't imagine being Harker, going to this man's house, trying to be polite. He gets like a sword put against his throat because he makes a little joke, and then he's holding his hands and there is wolf fur coming out of it. It's like, this is insane.
Well, and then we get the incredible shots here with the shadow play of the shadow my behind favorite. One of my absolute favorite moments, whatever I think about this movie, is, you know, Jonathan is showing him the contracts on a desk and there's the candlelight. And then when he sees the photo of, when Dracula sees the photo of Mina, who looks just like his Elizabeth from the beginning. I will say it like that all the time, by the way. Sorry about it. And you see his shadow start moving independently towards the photo and towards Jonathan. And, you know, this just sense of impending doom and impending kind of like danger that, you know, it's such a cool camera trick that, yeah, we've seen before, but here it's just done so perfectly. I feel like this is like the pinnacle of that kind of camera work and that kind of moment of terror, of horror. It's just, oh God. Every detail about this movie is just done so meticulously well. It's absolutely incredible. And I will say, as much as I love this movie, the first half, I think, is much stronger, in my opinion. I'm not sure how y'all feel about that. I just think that there are a lot more, like, deliberate aesthetic choices. I think there's a lot more dread building. I think the last half becomes more of an action movie as we have the group of guys, like, hunting him down. And obviously, you know, we get into more of, like, the guys trying to fight the monster territory. But the first half is just this, like, gothic, gross, sexy experience that I just like could live in, which
I agree the first half is perfect in its own way, but I do feel like when Hopkins shows up like right in the middle, like the movie goes to a place it kind of needs to, where it's like, okay, we're gonna like,
it gets its second wind almost,
it gets a second wind where it's like, okay, we need someone like this at this point to really push it to the end. And I feel like he's my favorite character in the whole thing. He just like really makes me laugh. Like every line reading he has is like just amazing. Just like, this is one I wrote down where it's like he's questioning Keanu about the brides and he's like, oh, what happened? And he's like trying to be like so innocent about it, and Keanu's like, I was impotent with fear. And then he's like, I know, like kind of being innocent, like, oh no, I know, I know, but just tell me about it. And just like, I don't know where that stuff's coming from, but he just like takes the movie to a different place that I do appreciate.
I think he brings the same energy that Gary Oldman is bringing to this performance. This sort of like, you know, we've seen Van Helsing so many times, and he's bringing sort of like, I mean, I don't want to say caricature, but there is a caricature of like the characters that we've seen up until that point of Van Helsing with his delicious like accent going on, and just an essence of camp that I think matches what Gary Oldman was bringing, particularly in the first part. And so I completely agree that when he shows up again, it's like the film gets re-energized. It needed that, because those three suitors, as hot as I would have thought they were growing up, they're really bland. They're so bland.
I know. And we have Cary Elwes as like the dashing British gentleman. We have Richard Grant Jr., who we've seen in Can You Ever Forgive Me? He plays the kind of creepy doctor who is addicted to opium and is also working at the institution where Renfield is being held. Renfield played by Tom Waits. Didn't realize that till my most recent watching of this movie. That is Tom Waits. And then we have the American cowboy with his big knife, all coming after our girl Lucy. Okay, just real quick. The scene where they all come in and she greets them all is my absolute favorite, because I just don't think that there are enough explicitly horny women in movies of this time period. I understand why a very different time sex was treated very differently, but she is just so openly like full of desire, and I understand that we can kind of see her being punished for that desire as the film progresses, as she is kind of targeted by Dracula and that kind of lustful behavior is punished, which is annoying, but I still love that her character is so full of life, and every time she sees one of her suitors come in, she's like, darling, and like gives them and like goes up to them like with the American guy. She's like, "It's so big," and she pulls out a knife. It's just
I know,
so,
it's so good,
ridiculous, but it's just so good. It's just like Coppola knows what he's doing. He's like, "I'm making a sex movie with a story that we all are know and love, but I'm going to imbue it with like a 90s grit that we don't." That we didn't have obviously in the book and wouldn't have in maybe earlier adaptations of this. And so now it's going to give it that edge. And I absolutely love that. Lucy is my favorite character in this movie. As I've gotten older watching it, Lucy's my favorite. Her arc is tragic. And I think a lot of it does kind of speak to the punishment of loose women, women who have sexuality. But I still love the shit out of her. I think she's got some incredible parts. She's got some incredible outfits. I think that her death, I think, is incredible when she is decapitated in the, there's a glass coffin, then she's decapitated, she's holding a baby and gonna eat it in this incredible, like, looks like a clown costume almost, with like this bonnet and giant collar. Like, it, again, it's campy, it's almost clownish, but it's done so well that it doesn't feel like ridiculous. It feels appropriate. It feels necessary. And I love that ability to take the camp, but make it feel not totally silly. I just think that's such an incredible like plus of this movie. Yeah.
Well, and you're talking about Lucy and the sexuality. And I love that there is a sequence in here that is dripping with metaphor where it's almost like an orgy with her, where it's like all three of the men are giving her blood. And there's the line afterwards, "That poor creature has had the blood of two men put in her already." Like, it's like they just had sex and they're all so exhausted from doing it. And it's like this moment of just pure metaphor around this idea of blood and blood being life and blood being sexual and violence and all that kind of stuff. It's just that sequence is so great.
And I mean, like, this is it's 92, the AIDS crisis. I mean, the AIDS crisis was still a huge thing, and having again, like, I don't think there's a lot of, like, to glean out of here about like an AIDS crisis metaphor, but thinking about that in that age and having them talk about like having that sex and blood exchange metaphor is pretty poignant, especially in 1992. Like, I think that is really interesting.
Well, and Van Helsing even brings it up when he's having that discussion about vampire bats and talking about syphilis, you know, that kind of blood disease. Like, that is definitely at the forefront of here. And I do think vampirism, particularly coming out of the 80s, there was like a huge connection between vampires and queerness and also vampires and AIDS, particularly with like Lost Boys, Near Dark is another one that kind of employed the same like impure blood type aspect of it, and to a lesser extent Fright Night as well. So like coming out of that into this, where it's like I think he knew what he was doing in terms of that kind of metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely remember AIDS in school like being such a huge thing. Like, there was, they'd teach us all about it, and like it was just such a huge topic, and they'd show videos about it, and people would come in, it's like, "I have AIDS, I'm going to talk to you about it, and nothing to be afraid of, we're just going to," like, it was just like everywhere, like, in the early 90s.
Everything I learned about AIDS from that time period was from 90210. There was an episode of 90210 about someone having AIDS, and he cuts himself in the kitchen, and I forget which female character, she's like, "It's okay," he's like, "No, don't touch," and it's like, it's really bad, but like, that's all I knew about in terms of, like, AIDS growing up, which... Yeah.
Media.
Okay, so I do want to talk about the cinematography in this movie too, because it is also quite stunning. I love the there's this whole moment where we have like Lucy and Mina dancing in the rain, the camera spinning back and forth. We have like the Demeter kind of coming into to land, the wolf escaping the zoo. There's like an Evil Dead almost camera shot of like zooming through like the London and up the steps to Lucy's room. It's like this whole like sequence that ends up with the culmination of the werewolf fucking. But it's like this there's so much life in this camera movement that is through this entire movie. But that moment in particular, I was like, I love the way this whole thing is edited together to be just a cacophony of different things kind of all coming together.
It's kind of surprising coming from Coppola, because he's such like an austere, usually like the Godfather. Yeah. The camera barely moves at all in those movies. So it's really surprising, actually.
Well, and it's like, it's dizzying. It's like you're drunk. It's like you're under the influence of something, which, again, I think that metaphor is coming in of like, oh, the Dracula's coming. Something is coming to London. Something, coming. Sorry. Something is like influencing. So, like, we are under the influence of something, and that something is terrifying, but also desirable, because we have Lucy and Mina like almost falling over each other. Their clothes are clinging to their bodies. It does feel, again, very sensual in the way that they're falling over each other, and the way that like they're like water, like, you know, they're wet, and they, you know, we all associate with like damp clothing clinging to women, especially their breasts. And it does kind of, and again, in the culmination of this storm with the sex scene, it does amp up that kind of sensuality, that sexual energy, that electricity that has kind of, I think, been building to this point. And it, you know, sorry, explodes with this situation with, wow. I'm sorry. But I also think something that's really interesting to me here, though, is we see these other forms, we're starting to see the more monstrous forms of Dracula, but how that monstrosity is also related to desirability, because we see him not just as an older man or as a young man, we see him as this wolf creature. And then we also see him throughout the film in other, like, other forms. And again, we, you know, in Dracula lore, we know he can be a bat, he can be a wolf, he can be mist, he can take all these forms. But again, these forms are still desirable. Like, even when he is a monster, he is obviously engaging non-consensual sexual activity with Lucy. I think we can all agree that is non-consensual sex happening with Lucy in the garden in her beautiful red robe, that I want one. But then we see her later. I know, sorry. But in later in the film, when Dracula's in his like weird bat monster states, we still have Mina as like Elisabetta, like lusting over him and having and desiring him. So there is this really interesting creation of Dracula as desirable no matter what, which plays into that vampiric lore of the sensuality of vampires. But I think with the visual language that Coppola is creating, especially around the different forms that Dracula takes, it's like all encompassing. Like, desire does not have to just be rooted in the physical appearance of somebody, but in their presence. And I think that's something that Gary Oldman does really well in terms of playing the character, but like
I have crossed oceans of time to find you.
When I tell you that's line. The sexiest thing a man could ever say to me, like I would just be like, "All right, cool. Like I'm yours. I'm a monster. Like it doesn't matter. Like,
take me now.
Like it's over." Sorry, husband in the other room. But like, well,
how attractive do you guys?
He cleared his throat very loudly and purposefully.
How attractive do you find Oldman in this movie, just in general?
So, okay. I have a pin set of him and Mina when he is at his hot, young form. Like, I have a pin set of the two of them on a blazer, because, obviously. But I think he is so hot in this movie. If that man came up to me and was like, hello, I'd be like, hi, stranger danger, none, zero, absolutely none. But, like, Gary Oldman is a complicated figure in my head as an actor. He is not the best person. He has done a lot. He has committed a lot of like acts of domestic violence and everything. Just to acknowledge that. But in this movie, I've never found him hotter. Like, he, I think, has so much charisma. And I think, you know, obviously he looks incredible in the top hat, the glasses, the suit. I think that is all working toward him for him. But again, the charisma and the presence he has, the way he speaks, the way he looks, the way he just, like, his whole face. Like, he is so fucking horny for Mina. If any man looked at me like that, like, not even in, like, a, like, piece of meat kind of way, but in, like, I have never been more obsessed with a person. And Gary Oldman captures that so perfectly in this movie. It's like, oh my god, Jesus, like, I'm overwhelmed watching you. Like, I'm not kidding. It's really impressive.
When he bursts from the crate, just looking like hot sex, I'm like, okay.
I need to take a break. sweating
so
a little
bit. You're picking Oldman over Keanu when it comes down to it? Are you
100%.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, 100. Okay. I'll keep it at 100 here. I would definitely do that. I'm sorry, Keanu. The gray hair is very hot. I'm into that look at the end.
Oh, he was not doing it for me.
I think it's
cute. It looked like it was like spray painted on. It looked so bad.
I think he... I just... the presence that Oldman has, like Dracula has, and Oldman has in this movie, it's overwhelming. Reed horny.
How many times have you said horny? Oh my god, yeah,
too. So, do you watch this movie a lot? Do you revisit it at all?
I'm sorry, that's just something you're asking. Mary Beth, do you watch this movie a lot?
Oh, no.
No, stop being horny.
No, but Paul, does this movie revisit a lot, or is this
It's one I YouTube a lot, where I'm like, I think about the scene where Lucy gets killed in the crypt, like pretty often. It's like, let me just fire that one up, because I feel like that's like the most rewatchable scene in the movie for me. So I feel like I YouTube it a lot, but it really was only like 10 or so years ago that I really sat down and watched it again, like after everything that happened.
Right.
I was like, oh, this is a great movie. This is just a great movie. Yeah. What was the question? I think I answered it.
Yeah. Just curious if this was one that you revisited a lot or not.
It is now. Yeah.
So it's, you know, the other thing that I find so funny about watching this movie now is that one of my favorite, and I talked about this on our episode where I watched this, like our little mini-sode that we do, but I watched Dracula Dead Loving It, the Mel Brooks movie from the 90s, which is totally, you know, a parody of this movie. And so
you're right.
Every time I watch this movie, I immediately am quoting Dracula Dead and Loving It. Like, particularly Lucy's death, where in here it's so gothic, and I love the way it unfolds. But in Dracula Dead and Loving It, there's this, you seen it?
Isn't that part where Steven Weber gets all the blood on him?
He's okay, like, yeah, staking it. And every time he does, it's like a geyser of blood is just drenching him. So that's what I think of every time I watch this movie. That and the earlier line of creatures of the night. What the mess they make, because the bat is shitting down. It's just so it's hard to watch this movie and not think about Dracula Dead Loving It for me, because that was the movie that I watched so much as a kid. Well, I guess as a teenager at that time. But like, yeah, so it's weird watching this movie and not thinking of Mel Brooks.
I love that that's one of your favorite movies and you just saw the actual Dram Stoker's Dracula last year. It's just, I love it. It's incredible.
I was going to say, I just was wondering what you guys thought was sort of the current cultural footprint of the movie, because when it came out, it was a hit, and there was a lot of parodies of it. Like, it had gotten into the culture. Like, I think The Simpsons did something on it, maybe. And
Mr.
I mean,
Burns
Mel Brooks parody. So, yeah. So, like, but now I'm wondering, like, is this a forgotten movie? It seems like our generation has kind of rediscovered it a little bit. But I don't know. What's your take on where this movie sits right now?
I think a lot of people in my sphere, like, horror people that aren't horror people specifically. So my friend who was like, do you want to watch Bram Stoker's Dracula with me and my newborn child? He's not a horror person, but he loves this movie. And I think because it's Coppola, I think it does still have power. And I think when you talk especially about like erotic horror cinema, I think people also talk about it. I think it's not a movie I feel like comes up a lot in conversation, like organically online, but I do think a lot of people appreciate it for what it is, especially. And I think from what I've seen on Twitter, what people actually have really seems to have stuck out is the costume design. I think that is the big thing that still sticks out when this movie's discussed is the costume designer and the work that she did specifically. I think that is what is kind of in the conversation. I still think it's pretty well regarded and discussed, like relatively speaking.
I mean, our listeners bullied me when they found out that I had never seen it before. So I don't think it comes up an awful lot, but I do think it's appreciated from what I've seen on like the online horror sphere. I would say.
Yeah. I think it's really different from a lot of the things we get today. and like more contemporary, because I think
Get erotic thrillers even? Like, when's the last time there was a hit?
So Terry and I, not just, but relatively, again, last year did a whole series on our minisodes about erotic thrillers and like went through erotic thrillers from the decades. And we were talking about it. Like, erotic thrillers don't really exist that much anymore. Like, cinema actually feels much more sanitized than it was in, like, the 90s in terms of sexuality and sensuality. Like, it is actually very strange to see how prudish cinema has become. And especially with, like, there isn't a lot of sensuality in horror. I think that there are, but I think that this kind of a combination of eroticism and terror isn't really that common, especially now. And, yeah, I think what this movie accomplishes, stealing your words, Terry, operatic, sumptuous, it's sensual, and I don't think that's really, like, that caught. I haven't seen a movie that could really be compared to this, I don't think, ever.
Can we also briefly talk, though, about the special effects in this movie that are just next level, considering that I did find, like, a quote, or not even a quote, but, like, an article about how he did not want to use computer-generated imagery. He did not want to do any... Mm-hmm. He wanted to use, like, antiquated effects. And so there's a lot of, like, optical or on-set motions and camera cutaways and stuff. But there are some really awesome moments in here. I love... And it's the moment that has stuck with me since I was a kid playing the Sega CD game, is when he's a bat and he turns the cross on fire. Yeah, he's just like, moving back and forth, and the cross just bursts on flames. It's so good. Or the moment when, like, he retreats into the shadows, and then the light hits, and he's just a pile of rats that
turns into the rats.
Collapse.
Yeah, wow.
It's
that's
so,
like,
good.
It's so flawless sometimes, where it's just like, there's barely any seams. Like, it's so convincing. I don't even think in the 90s people could have been aware that it was, like, old techniques. I think they would have been, probably went over their heads, really. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of crazy.
I love the way the camera, like the scene that I just, it's so subtle, but it's so good, is when Harker gets picked up from the carriage, and there's this man or something, you know, on the carriage, and he has, like...
That's never addressed again, by the way. The weird, like, ring wraith from fucking Lord of the Rings, like, guiding
with, like,
the
feather
carriage.
Armor almost. But his arm goes out, and it's, like, longer, because the camera keeps panning, and it's longer than it ever has any right to be. And it just, like, takes his shoulder and pulls him in. And it's such a subtle moment, but it's, like, there is something completely off with here. And then when we get to the castle doesn't obey laws of physics. Like, Dracula is able to climb, which, like, you know, you think, okay, he's a vampire. But then there's that scene where Harker's escaping, and he's on the edge of the castle, and his feet are moving, and he tries to go across the edge, and all of a sudden... The edge is as if, like, he's falling down, and it's such a disorienting, dizzying display of, like, no gravity, or how gravity is fucked up at this castle. It's so wild.
I definitely want to try to rip some of this stuff off on the next movie. Like, okay, we got to go back to these techniques, because it's just, they're just so perfect. I don't know. God.
They're so good. Jesus. So, like, I feel like we could talk about this movie for 6 more hours, but... Do we want to start wrapping up and give it a rating out of 5? Is there anything else we want to touch on really quick? I know there's so much we could talk about, but, you know, do we feel comfortable moving towards wrapping up?
Yes, but I am curious, Paul. What did your friend that you watched it with, what did he think? Did you guys ever talk about this movie again?
It never came up again, you know? I think we just sort of, one of those weird things you witness your friend doing and you just don't. Maybe just don't bring it up. Like, there was stuff I saw of him that was like, oh, you really got beat up there, didn't you? But I'm not going to bring that up. Stuff like that. I think he recognized that maybe it's best to not talk about that, because I was a weirdo and I did a weird thing.
Did it affect you after watching the movie at all? Like, after seeing it, other than the fear of your mom catching you?
Other than the shame of... running out of the room. I mean, that was probably the worst part. Just the shame. Just the deep shame.
The shame.
Yeah, and feeling like I did something wrong. Feeling like I did, like, you know what I mean? And it's tough. I just want to be like, there's nothing wrong. Just, like, enjoy the movie if you can. But at the time, it really felt like I'd done something wrong. And, yeah. So I feel like I came to terms with it here, though. I feel like I've never really talked about it to anyone, really. Or, like, definitely not in public, that's for sure.
It's just us. There's no one else listening to this. It's okay.
I mean, when I submitted, like, yeah, let's do Bram Stoker, as I was thinking about it last night, I was like, why am I going to say this on a podcast? This is a bad idea.
You're like, yay! Come join us talking about pervy shit.
I was so excited when that email came in and that was the choice. Okay. I was like, yes!
The text I got from Terry in all caps, Bram Stoker's Dracula, I was like, oh, it's the best day ever.
And then I was like, I hope he's okay if we're a little horny about it. Because, like, this movie is incredibly erotic. It just is.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Well, let's wrap this sucker up and give this movie a rating out of 5. Terry, how many werewolf fucks out of 5? We picked this without knowing Paul's history with this movie. I'm so glad we went with it. So happy we did. It's so funny.
5. I think this is a perfect horror movie. Yes, maybe there's some issues in the middle part where it needs to, like, progress to the next stage, and then it does. But I think this, every time I watch this movie, I'm just wrapped up in its majesty. And I've only seen it like 3 times in the last year. This is the 3rd time I've watched it. And every single time I'm just like, this, I could live in this world forever. I do think it's funny though that I was wondering as I was watching this, because we just recently watched Devil's Advocate, and I'm like, what is it with Keanu in the 90s picking movies that are erotic and are filled with bad accents? Because we have this movie and that movie, like, I think 6 years later, that is, again, an incredibly erotic film that has some questionable accents in it. But yeah, I think this movie is great.
Worked, you know, you saw what worked.
You know what?
He leaned into it.
And here's the thing. Yes, I would pick Gary Oldman over Keanu in this movie, but the Keanu in Devil's Advocate is...
Okay, we're not talking about that, Terry.
Keanu or Pacino, though? That's good.
Pacino, sorry.
Pacino.
Okay. Wow, okay.
Do Pacino, we have things for older men?
There's... listeners, go listen to our Devil's Advocate podcast, because... yeah, that, yeah. Anyway, this movie's 5. It's gorgeous. I love the effects. I love the performances. I love the design of it. I can't say anything else about it. What about you, Mary Beth? Do you give it 1?
Every werewolf fuck imaginable. 5 werewolf fucks for me. This movie is like, it's a fucking masterpiece, literally and figuratively. It is absolutely gorgeous. Every time I watch it, I find something new to love about it. I never get bored watching it. And this is just a movie I'm so excited whenever someone is like, I haven't seen it. I'm like, we have to watch it together. And it's just like such a fun experience, because I've now watched it with several people who aren't horror people who have watched it and been like, that was incredible. And I love that it transcends that kind of genre label that might get people nervous to watch it. And it woos them with the beauty of what it's creating. And I think that speaks to the power, not just of the story, but to have Coppola's ability to tell the story and the way that he chose to tell the story. And I think it's just like a damn near perfect movie for me. So this is a 5. Werewolf fucks in a 5. And then Paul, you have the final word.
You know, before I watched it again, I would have said 5. Okay. But I feel like when I watched it last night, I think some of the love story stuff wasn't like totally clicking for me. Like that big operatic love story. Like, I found myself much less interested in that stuff. So like, I almost want to say 4.5 just because I saw a flaw, but let's just do 5. Yeah, we'll do 5.
All right, cool.
Yeah, 5.
Hell yeah.
With a little caveat that maybe I don't love all the love story scenes.
That's fair.
Great where it lands on, though. I love where it ends with a shot above, and then we cut to Coppola's title. Like, I love the last couple moments, though. So I feel like in the end, it really works for me, and that's why I'll give it 5. But I was a little, like, on the fence the whole time. Like, is this love story just too big, and is it not like down to earth enough? But let's do 5.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Paul, for joining us to talk about Bram Stoker's Dracula. Because
so glad
it's so good. Where can the listeners find you if you have an online space, and what do you have coming up? The floor is yours. What would you like to what do you have to share?
Let's see. I think I just have an Instagram for Landlocked. I think it's just like Landlocked underscore film. It's up there. It's coming out January 6th from Dark Sky. You should be able to find it at, you know, the usual spots. And then next, there's going to be a documentary about Psychonauts 2. It's coming out. I know you'll be excited about this very soon. So it's kind of like made concurrently with Landlocked. So it's kind of like they're a little bit like sister movies in a way. But
oh, yeah.
Oh, so cool.
Very different, though. Very different kinds of movies. But so that's coming out soon, really soon. And then I'll be starting right after Landlocked comes out. I'm going to finish the script for the next one. So hopefully I can get the next one going soon. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Stop being in this Landlocked world. I'm ready to move on to something else. Jesus
Christ. Yeah, I bet.
I can't
that many years working on it. I mean, it's got to be nice to have it out.
It's weird to not work on it anymore. It's like, I got a few ideas left. Hang on. Let me just take one more crack at it. Like, it's really like, sometimes it's like, yeah, just take it. But for this, it's like, maybe I could shoot a little more, one more scene here, add that in. And, you know, but that's okay. I'm trying to let it go and not be too sad. So.
Well, listeners, you have heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with Bram Stoker's Dracula? You can send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us directly on Twitter. I'm at MBMcAndrews.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on Twitter at scarredpodcast.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, sign up on Patreon.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please stay safe out there. But most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.
As a person with a very deep voice, I'm hired all the time for advertising campaigns. But a deep voice doesn't sell B2B, and advertising on the wrong platform doesn't sell B2B either. That's why if you're a B2B marketer, you should use LinkedIn ads. LinkedIn has the targeting capabilities to help you reach the world's largest professional audience. That's right, over 70 million decision makers all in one place. All the big wigs, then medium wigs. Also small wigs who are on the path to becoming big wigs. Okay, that's enough about Wix. LinkedIn ads allows you to focus on getting your B2B message to the right people. So, does that mean you should use ads on LinkedIn instead of hiring me, the man with the deepest voice in the world? Yes. Yes, it does. Get started today and see why LinkedIn is the place to be, to be. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What is The Briefing Room?
It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the criminal justice system works and the lives of the people within that system.
If you love true crime, well, these are the real people who do the job every day of making sure justice is served.
Hi, I'm Detective Dave.
I'm Detective Dan. Together, we have decades of experience in local law enforcement, a profession that we think is often misunderstood.
So we're going to explore how to do it right, and we won't shy away from when it's done wrong.
These are stories you'll hear nowhere else. Unique, frank, and unvarnished.
From the team that brought you Small Town Dicks, this is The Briefing Room. Episode 1 drops on August 30th.
We'll meet you in The Briefing Room.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.